firm and you were appointed in this case, and we do thank you for your vigorous advocacy on behalf of your client.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the final case of the day. Excuse me, Jeffrey White versus Donald Gitz, 08-2766. Mr. Lotion.
May it please the court. I hope the court will excuse me. I'm recovering from laryngitis, so I hope you'll excuse my voice this morning.
We like lawyers that have laryngitis.
I can imagine. I may be brief. This case presents a fundamental question, and that is whether jurors may be selected in the unrestrained discretion of an interested official. In the ordinary course, potential jurors are selected using some sort of random or objective process, some sort of neutral official to do the selecting. But the process here dispensed with all of that. During Mr. White's voir dire, the court deemed the ordinary jury pool exhausted and handed the task of recruiting jurors to the sheriff. It gave the sheriff, the county's chief law enforcement officer, complete discretion to select anyone of his choice. That process was fundamentally unfair. Just as it would be unfair to delegate jury selection to the public defender, it was also unfair to delegate it to the sheriff. And the result of that process was a group of bystander jurors selected by the sheriff that was not representative of the community. It was composed entirely of government employees.
There's a potential procedural default issue here because it looks like this issue was litigated essentially as a statutory claim through the state court system, that the procedures that are prescribed in the statute for this exigency weren't properly followed. It wasn't really framed as a constitutional claim.
Yes, Your Honor, and there were statutory arguments made to the Illinois state courts, but the petitioner here did expressly invoke his constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. And so the bottom line of petitioner's state court arguments was a constitutional bottom line, just as the bottom line of the argument we're making here is a constitutional bottom line. The brief details various problems under the Illinois statute with what happened here, but the bottom line of overlooking a number of requirements of the Illinois statute was that the sheriff had complete discretion to select anyone of his choice, and that there were no restraints whatsoever on the sheriff's authority. And that bottom line, complete discretion in the hands of an interested official, is what creates the constitutional problem. And that's the constitutional problem that the petitioner referred to in his petition before the state court. And with respect to that constitutional
problem...
But
that's also an Illinois constitutional requirement as well, correct?
That's correct, and the state makes this argument that we don't really know whether whether he was referring to the Illinois Constitution or the federal Constitution, but I submit that as specific reference to one's constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury certainly gives the state an opportunity to consider the error under both the state constitution and the federal constitution. And the fair preservation requirement, it's important to remember, is not to be applied hyper-technically. It's simply, the purpose of it is simply to give the state courts an opportunity to correct the error. And so the fact that they could have corrected a state constitutional error as well as a federal constitutional error doesn't defeat... doesn't mean that the issue wasn't adequately raised.
If you can get by the procedural difficulties in this case,
yes.
Where is the Supreme Court case that's closely analogous that?
I would say there are a number of cases. I'd specifically highlight two for you right now, although we've cited more in our briefs. The first one is Castaneda v. Partida. And that was a case that involved a process called the key man process that gives discretion to officials to select to select potential jurors, and the result of that process and that discretion in Castaneda was a jury pool that underrepresented Mexican Americans. And the Supreme Court held that a procedure like that, that gave so much discretion to these officials and that resulted in an unrepresentative jury pool, was unconstitutional.
What class was underrepresented in this jury?
I'm sorry?
What class was underrepresented in this jury?
In this jury,
we're only talking about one juror.
That's correct.
So what class was underrepresented in the selection of that one juror?
Well, in this case, actually, the government employees were overrepresented. The pool that was used to fill that one spot was composed 100% of government employees. And so I would submit that this is an easier case in some ways than the case of Castaneda or other cases, for example, Durin or Taylor, where you're trying to figure out whether some particular discrete class is underrepresented in the pool. The case here involves a pool that contained 100% government employees.
Well, you're trying to narrowly define the pool as the veneer that is used after the 10 people were seated. I mean, shouldn't we really look at the entire veneer from which all 12 people were selected instead of you're trying to narrow it to after they ran out of jurors, we need to get some more people?
No, Your Honor. And I think the reason is, well, there are two reasons. The first, it's important to keep in mind that those three government employees weren't simply selected by the sheriff and then added to some larger pool that may have been representative of the community. Instead, one slot on the jury was filled entirely with that pool of bystander jurors that was brought in from by the sheriff. So it wasn't. It's not as though this unrepresentative group of jurors was just a drop in the bucket of some larger pool from which jurors were drawn. And the second point is that under the Supreme Court's cases, it's clear that jurors must be selected from a pool that's representative of the community. And I don't think it's consistent with that principle to select some jurors from a pool that's representative of the community and then select other jurors from a pool that's not representative of the community or a pool that's composed entirely of government employees. Like
why are governmental employees a distinctive group under the Durin analysis? I mean, all the cases you cite deal with the systematic exclusion of either women or African-Americans or Mexican-Americans. And so how is this akin to that?
It's true we're not talking about race or gender, Your Honor, but I would say in some ways government employees are actually more distinctive and more significant in the context of a criminal trial than gender or race, the categories that the Supreme Court has found to be distinctive groups, because a criminal trial involves a defendant standing against the state who's prosecuting that defendant and multiple government employees who are often called to testify and submit evidence and testimony. And so the government employees, there's a natural affinity that government employees may have with the other government employees whose actions they're examining as jurors and with the state that's sort of on the other side of the courtroom from the defendant and is prosecuting the defendant. I see that I am running into my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Fisher.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counselor, may it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Garson Fisher for the respondent. First, I'll begin by responding to Petitioner's argument regarding procedural default. The Supreme Court made it clear in Baldwin that a simple reference to language that's found in federal constitutional litigation is not enough to notify a state court about a federal constitutional claim. This is very similar, I think, to the reference to ineffective assistance of appellate counsel in the Baldwin case. There is a single reference to this language, which is familiar in some federal constitutional litigation, as well as in Illinois constitutional litigation, But in the context of a discussion of a state statutory claim, that did not call to mind any specific federal constitutional claim that the Illinois State Court could address. In fact, if it calls to mind any claim, it would probably be an impartial juror claim rather than a fair cross-section claim. At no point in his state briefings did petitioner even allege that the standby veneer was not a representative cross-section. There is a reference that the standby veneer consisted largely of government employees, but there's no discussion that there's a fair cross-section claim that's attempting to be raised in any way by this Illinois statutory claim. So the state court never had an opportunity in this case to correct the alleged error because it was never presented to the state court. But putting aside that hurdle to petitioner receiving relief, as Your Honor pointed out, there is no Supreme Court precedent that announces a rule that petitioner can now rely on to get relief in this case. The case that petitioner chose to highlight, Castaneda, as you said, dealt with the systematic exclusion of Mexican Americans from the veneer as a whole. There are two significant ways in which that rule is more of a departure from the rule that petitioner now seeks to have this court apply than a rule rejected as grounds for relief in cases like Wright v. Van Patten and Musladeen. That case did deal with the whole veneer. This case deals with a small portion of the veneer from which a single juror was selected. And second, the U.S. Supreme Court has never identified a distinctive class that wasn't based on immutable characteristics such as race, gender, country of origin. And the characteristic that allegedly comprises the distinctive class here, person's employer, the Supreme Court's never stated a rule that a veneer, whole or partial, would violate a defendant's constitutional rights if it consisted of people from a single employer. We've also argued that any error that did occur would be harmless under the Brecht standard that applies in 2254 habeas cases. So for any of these three independent reasons, either because petitioner never presented the claim that he now argues when he appealed his case to the state courts, and that the claim is therefore procedurally defaulted, or that even if he did present his claim, the state courts holding that his jury selection claim, quote, must fail, was neither contrary to nor an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent because that Supreme Court precedent simply doesn't exist, or because even putting aside these obstacles to relief, which the petitioner cannot do, any error would be harmless under Brecht, where the petitioner confessed repeatedly and his confessions were supported by the physical evidence in the case. And I will point out, just in quick response to something mentioned in petitioner's reply brief, that the statute under which the defendant was charged allows not only for intentional murder but also knowing murder. So his statement that when he aimed a loaded gun at the victims and repeatedly pulled the trigger, his intent might have been something other than to kill the victims, does not in any way demonstrate that the outcome of this trial was ever in doubt, given his repeated confessions. That for all of these reasons, as well as those stated in the respondent's briefs, unless Your Honors have additional questions, respondent will respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas relief.
Mr. Loesche.
I'd like to just address three issues raised by the state and then make one closing point. First, with regard to the Baldwin case that the state has identified, the important distinction between Baldwin and this case is that in Baldwin, the court recognized that the petitioner had not given, quote, the factual description supporting its claim. So it hadn't given the state court the operative facts it needed in order to rule on the federal claim that was allegedly raised before the state courts. Here, the operative facts were given, and although there was a focus on the state statute and Illinois law here, the petitioner did identify the fact that the jurors were brought in from government offices and were selected by the sheriff, and then gave the bottom line there that it impinged the petitioner's constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. And although the petitioner didn't use the specific words fair cross-section, I would submit that that kind of hyper-technicality is not required when we're talking about the fair presentation requirement. And although he didn't use those magic words, he did make reference to his constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. The second point I'd like to respond to is the point about harmless error. And there are really two points here. First, the error was harmless here, and I see that my time's up. Let me just finish this thought very quickly, if I may. He could have been convicted of second-degree murder or involuntary manslaughter. And although he testified that he put his hand through the roof of the car and shot the gun without intending to hit anybody, and that was corroborated by physical evidence, including two bullet holes in the car, suggesting that he wasn't aiming directly at Williams and instead just put the gun out of the car without directly aiming it. And so I would submit that that's not specific intent to kill, or certainly a jury could find that there wasn't specific intent to kill and could have convicted him of a lesser offense.
So you're not maintaining that this is structural error?
I am, and that was the second point I was going to get to, except my time was running out. But yes, I am maintaining that harmless error analysis doesn't even apply here, because in the many cases where the court has dealt with this kind of error, with fair cross-section error, the court has reversed regardless of prejudice and has held that that sort of error is structural, that it's essentially the fair cross-section requirement is a prophylactic rule, and so we don't even look to harmlessness. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Loschen, you have the thanks of the court for accepting the appointment here and doing such a fine job for your client. Thank you.